Welcome to another episode of Know Your Ombud. This is a series of conversations aimed to help you, as a consumer of financial services, understand your rights and where to go if you are not treated fairly. The financial ombud schemes include the FASE Ombud, the JSC Ombud, the Pension Funds Adjudicator, and the National Financial Ombud, all of which are overseen by the Ombud Council. Lodging a complaint with an ombud is free, and you do not have to appoint a lawyer. And let's be honest, what else in life do you get for free? In each episode, we speak to one of the lead ombuds to understand the cases they deal with and how the ombud adjudicates complaints. We examine cases where the ombud has ruled in favor of the consumer and those that go in favor of the institution. This helps to explain our rights, but also our responsibilities. The National Financial Ombud is responsible for handling complaints from customers of banks, credit providers, short-term and long-term insurance. And today, focus is on long-term insurance. And we're chatting to Sonia Maria, Senior Adjudicator for the Life Insurance Division. So welcome, Sonia. I'm looking so forward to this discussion because long-term insurance, you know, it's you must have your job cut out for you.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
So, Sonia, typically what kind of complaints come through to you and what are the sort of issues you have? But also maybe if you can explain to the listeners, when is it an advice issue and when is it a product issue? Because obviously when it comes to life insurance, sometimes the issue is that you got bad advice and sometimes it's product failure.
You can submit any complaint to the NFO. We are set up in a way that we review all the complaints. We will then refer, if it's not for our office, for example, it's for FASE or for the Pension Fund Adjudicator, we'll refer to them. Otherwise, it will then be referred to the senior adjudicators internally for investigation. And typically, it's about the non-payment of claims. Yeah, where complainants have not met or the claim hasn't met the terms and conditions of the policy.
Mm. And how, I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about claims where you have gone in favor of the consumer, but how important is non-disclosure? How often do you come up as non-disclosure as a major issue in the rejection of a claim?
It does happen from time to time. I think in our statistics from last year's annual report, 5% were non-disclosures, which is not that many. Mm. I think it was around 5%. So it's not that many, but it does happen. It's often a tricky situation where, complainants do not, or applicants at that stage do not disclose all the information. Sometimes there's a broker involved that informs them that it's not necessary to disclose certain things. Other times they are assisted by somebody at the insurer to complete. So different scenarios, but yeah, we do have those challenging ones.
And I think those are the ones that often make the headline news. Yes. So we know about them. And it's quite interesting when you said the broker may advise them, because of course it's in the interest of a broker for the policy to be accepted. So they may possibly leave out certain information, but then that would actually fall under the FASE Ombud terms of bad advice. So I think this is what's so interesting for me in this journey of speaking to all the different ombuds at the moment is understanding that, you know, you now can just take it to the NFO and it'll be decided where it's allocated instead of us poor consumers trying to figure out who we're supposed to be speaking to. Now, as a journalist and the complaints I get, I often find that long-term insurance is one of those tricky ones because there's a lot of T's and C's, especially when it comes to things like disability and what is critical illness. How do you take that treating the customer fairly kind of view versus the legal contract? Because that can be different.
Yeah, the contract is the basis for the agreement between the consumer and the insurer. So we can't ignore the contract. And so that's where it starts. But when we are evaluating the complaint, we look at how the contract provisions are applied by the insurer, whether the consumer was informed upfront of all the T's and C's, for example, things like waiting periods or a definition of disability or medical conditions that were included in the policy, how the premium is calculated. So a number of things, we look at that. And if that's the basis of why the complaint was declined or the claim we look at, is it reasonable? Are the terms reasonable?
That whole idea of treating customers fairly, I think, feeds really well into the first case study I wanted to discuss. Because this really, I think, also highlights the issue of employee benefits and when this is understood and how well these are understood. So I'm just going to give a little bit of an overview for our listeners, but there was a driver of a heavy load vehicle, and he'd lost most of his eyesight in his right eye, and he couldn't perform his job. And his employer said, sorry, you can't continue to work, but don't worry, we have insurance, you can go and claim from the insurer. And the insurer rejected his claim because their insurance had something to do with your own versus any occupation. And they were saying, well, you can go and do any occupation. You may not be able to continue to drive, but you can do other things. And they declined his claim. But you said it was not fair. Yes. And I think this is a very important case.
Yeah. In that instance, if you think about the job of a driver and he drove a fuel tanker, it's quite risky. So good vision is important. So I understand the employer's decision to terminate his service and apply for incapacity. But in terms of the policy contract, the insurer declined it, yes, because the criteria or the definition of disability was not for his job as a driver. It was actually for any occupation, and not just any occupation at the employer, but any occupation in the open labor market, which really is very wide. So at the age of 57, that particular gentleman, yes, he had impairment in the right eye, but there was also a little bit of impairment in the left eye, was required to go into the open labor market and look for a new job. Already he had a disability to start with. His age counted against him. His limited skills counted against him. So we look at, although it says any occupation, when the insurer makes that recommendation or they decline the claim, we then revert to reasonability and fairness. And we look at, is it reasonable to expect someone at that age with that level of education, that experience, that knowledge, limited transferable skills to start fresh in the open labor market? And in that instance, we didn't think it was fair or equitable or reasonable. Yeah, so we made the recommendation. We asked them to relook it, and they came back and decided to approve the claim.
You know, Sonia, for me, that case highlighted two things for me when I was reading through it. One was the amount of work that the ombud went into to understand the medical side of it, which was really interesting for me. And I think, you know, as a layperson, or, you know, you don't have the ability to go and look at all of that information. You pulled on medical records. You really were able to investigate the case properly, which, again, just what we're trying to do in these discussions is remind people of what the ombud can do for them for free, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to go and get a lawyer to go and do all of these things. But the other one for me was this idea of any occupation for employee benefits. So I see all these companies offering employee benefits saying, don't worry, you've got disability cover. But this, what you don't realize is what is that disability cover?
Yeah.
And what does any occupation actually mean? And do you find that that is something that you come across quite frequently?
That is one of the main issues that we find, that the person who is covered, and often the employer as well, the policyholder, they don't always fully understand what it means, what that definition of disability means. So in the case of the gentleman, there are a lot of employees covered under the policy. So that any occupation requirement or limitation is specific to the drivers, where all the others, it wouldn't be applicable to them. So that's something, for example, that the employer wouldn't necessarily pick up on immediately. People also don't know what they are covered for. They don't know that there's a definition. They think, I'm disabled, I've lost vision in my eye, my other eye is not so good either, and that I'm going to, of course, get my disability benefit. And the employer also, assume that once they find the person to be disabled, they have sufficient medical evidence that the insurer is going to do the same. But it doesn't happen that way.
I think what I took from that was just the importance of checking and understanding your employee benefits, but also as the employer. I think the employers have the consultant comes in, sells it to them, and they don't really understand. Because in this case, certainly the employer was very much under the impression that this driver would be looked after.
Yeah.
Because that's what they were paying for, right?
Yes.
They paid for this person's disability cover and felt they'd done the right thing and he was let down. But you had another case, which was a similar case, but you went in you ruled in favor of the insurer in this case. So this one was a mine worker dismissed on medical grounds because he had a lung condition that didn't allow him to work underground. But again, it was any occupation. And in this case, you felt that the insurer was correct in not paying out on disability. Why?
Yeah. In that case, yes, the mine doctor declared him unfit for his job, which was underground. But the mines are a little tricky in that they also look at the mine health and safety fitness requirements. So the mine doctor has the mine doctor may declare somebody disabled in terms of those requirements, but those requirements differ to the policy contract again. So many of the insurers who cover benefits in the mining industry, they include the mine health and safety or the mine fitness requirements in the policy, but there are those that don't. So if the medical occupational medical practitioner uses his discretion and he declares the person disabled, like in this instance, it is possible that, again, the insurer might not find the person disabled. And the contract in this case is or. So it's the one or the other one, but then one also has to go a bit further. You mentioned us looking at the medical information earlier on. In this instance, he had an impairment, but it wasn't that severe. In fact, it didn't even comply with the criteria for the minimum standards on the mine. So we looked at that. We looked at the reasonability of above ground work, which is reasonable. The reason why they terminated his services in the end was the availability of work. So yes, the doctor said he's not fit for work, which means he doesn't get his red ticket to go underground. But there's also the issue of the medical information doesn't support the insurer's, the policy requirement.
So it can get subtle. It is a subtle, nuanced thing. But at the end of the day, he could continue to work. He was young enough. He could carry on working above ground if there was a job available. And it's not up to the insurer to pay out because there isn't a job available.
Exactly.
So I think it's important. And I think this is where having an independent adjudicator like yourself who can look at the facts dispassionately, saying how does it work, is actually really important. Now, these have been very much on disability, which I always think is a bit tricky because for the exact reasons we've discussed. But you were saying to me when I was looking also at your annual report, you mostly get complaints about life insurance claims. And I always think life policies are easy because you're either dead or alive. You know, there's no question about is this a disability. But the big issue are who gets the money, also with funeral policies. So maybe unpack that a little bit for me.
Yeah, with funeral policies, often that is the issue. With death, it is the beneficiary nominated. And with funeral policy, it is whether the person who has been insured should have been insured. Did you have the right? Are you related? It's about whether... what we call insurable interest.
Mm.
So what is your interest in the person? And the policy, most of the policies or the insurers require the person to be a family member. So it would be your parents-in-law, your brother, your sister, your cousin. That's how your uncles as well. But if it gets to extended family, you know, cousins, your distant cousin or an aunt that you call mom, or the issue of culture also comes into it, perhaps raising a child that you then take on as your own, but it's not legally adopted. It's not your child. So there isn't, you cannot insure the person. So in those instances, the policy won't pay out. Perhaps I can also just add that fraud is quite rife in the funeral business. So insurers are careful. If there are 8 people who insured the same person, it is a red flag to insurers. Then there's also the issue in terms of death benefits, how the person, for example, died. If there is any suspicion of
murder,
mm-hmm. yes, that is flagged and that the insurer wouldn't pay, they might not outright say, or that the beneficiary is a suspect in a crime, how the death occurred. Mm. Were you involved in risky activities? Mm. And what, yeah.
So a lot of questions around, it's interesting, a lot of questions around the beneficiaries. But I think the insurers also need to be held a little bit accountable here about, you know, they only do the investigation on claims and not up front. So they've received all these premiums. They're very happy to take the premiums up front for years and years and years. And then on claim stage, they say, well, that child that you raised wasn't actually your child. And maybe you had a policy that we've received money for many, many years, but not your child. So how do you view that? Because I think, should they not be doing more, you know, more investigation up front before you take the policy out?
Yeah. The question has come up and the insurer often says, but should we do all that investigation just to decline it because or not accept the cover at all? Because they might not do it, and who's going to pay for it? So there are other issues that come into play, you know, the cost and the time that it's going to take, and then the person might decide, I'm not taking the cover. So they inform the policyholder or the applicant that these are just questions. For example, in the case of known non-disclosure, these are just basic questions. We will do a further investigation at a later stage, make sure you disclose. So they do inform the applicant that they're going to do investigation later. Mm. I think the extent of the investigation is often underestimated. Mm. And that's why I think people might think it's okay to just leave out that operation that I went for last year, 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah. Mm. So yes, it is. I think it's a cost thing, but I do think that it is also mentioned by a lot of complainants. Why wasn't it done up front? Mm.
It is an issue. I mean, people do think when you think you have cover and you discover you don't, at the time you need it, it is a big issue.
Yeah.
So maybe that's something. Maybe it's also just education around making sure that you've disclosed everything. And I think it's very interesting. I must be honest, I didn't know you couldn't take funeral cover out for non-family member. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want, you know, people to be taking out. You know, there's unfortunately a lot of fraud, as you said. But I think for a lot of people, what they call family is defined differently. And I think if you have somebody that you're caring for and you're raising them and they're not directly a blood relative, at least tell your insurer and tell the policy, the insurer, and say, this is the person I'm taking the policy out. Would they be covered?
Yeah.
And maybe it's just also important from us as consumers to be educated around this.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And insurers would often contact the person being insured and ask, mm-hmm. do you know this person? Are you happy with this person taking out the policy mm-hmm. on your life? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You also get fraud there. Must admit that it's not the actual person on the telephone. So, but
yeah,
it does happen.
It's just sad that we have a situation where people are actually prepared to, unfortunately, kill people for money. Yeah. But anyway, on that very somber note, thank you, Sonia. And I really appreciate your time here. And I think it's given me a lot of insight into how you go about making your investigations. And to our listeners, I really hope that listening to these case studies gives you some insights into the amount of investigation that goes into it and to the benefit of going to an ombud. If you're unhappy, you don't have to go and get a lawyer and go and fight insurers in court. You don't have to go to social media. And one of the challenges, of course, of going to social media is that you are now in the public eye. You become the story very quickly. When you can actually resolve a lot of these things simply by going to an ombud, it is a free service. So please keep listening, listen to my other discussions with the other ombuds, and learn all about your rights and where to go if you're unhappy with the service you are receiving.